Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 21st, unlike the agenda that says today is Wednesday, March 21st.
Yeah.
First order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Szczesinski moves approval of the minutes dated Monday, September 21st. Is there any discussion, corrections, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. Also, Representative Mahoney moves approval of the minutes dated March 16th. Is there any discussion? Any discussion or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have three bills on our agenda today, as well as agency overviews of the governor's supplemental budget. On the agenda, the first thing we have is the Commissioner of Deed, Katie Clark-Seven. Is she here? Commissioner, if you want to come on up. And so, members, our discussion today is going to be on the governor's supplemental budget. So certainly lots of other questions agencies are doing or not doing. We could go far afield of that. Let's try to keep our conversation focused on the supplemental budget proposals. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Katie Clark-Seven, Commissioner of Deed.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith have proposed a fiscally responsible budget to protect Minnesota's financial future while making critical investments in an economy that works better for all Minnesotans. Thank you for inviting me here today to join you to discuss Governor Dayton's supplemental budget proposals for DEED. First, let me give you just a very brief reminder of the work that we do at the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. DEED is the state of Minnesota's principal economic development agency. Our mission is to enhance the economic success of individuals, businesses, and communities. We have over 1,500 dedicated staff across the state supporting workforce development, economic development, and research and analysis, all working together to make Minnesota economically competitive.
Commissioner, so is this the handout, or is there, are they, because my old man eyes are having problems, so is it going to be on the monitor or not?
We could put it on the monitor. Would you prefer that we?
While you're talking, if someone could maybe set that up, just because, I don't know, maybe I'm the only one who can't read the 6-point font. Okay. I've been told by counsel I'm not alone. I have glasses on, Tim. Thanks. Yes.
Okay.
So if you could just continue, and then we'll kind of, if we can get the presentation set up, we'll go from there. Commissioner,
okay.
Please continue. My apologies.
No problem. Mr. Chair, members, so I am on the second side, supplemental budget recommendations, and I will talk you through what's on the slide so that you can know what we're talking about. So as we begin to discuss the governor's budget proposals for DEED, it's helpful to provide some economic context. Minnesota's economy has experienced a resurgence over the past 3 years. More than 190,000 jobs we've created since the start of 2011, while our unemployment rate is nearly 2 points below the national rate. Last year, CNBC ranked Minnesota the top state for business in America. This is not the full story, though, because we know that not every Minnesotan is feeling the benefits of this economic growth. While economic disparity by race, in particular, has been a persistent economic problem for our state, recent census data highlights that black families have recently been losing even more ground to their white counterparts. This occurs at a time when Minnesota's labor market is tightening. With the rapid exit of baby boomers from the labor force, the number of available workers is not growing quick enough to keep pace with the job market. That's part of the reason that several of Governor Dayton's proposals and part of his larger equity budget are focused on addressing disparities in our state. To keep our state economically competitive, we need to get every Minnesotan into the workforce to fill our in-demand jobs. The governor's budget also recognizes the importance of our infrastructure for our economic future. With major investments in broadband and redevelopment, DEED will be able to catalyze new private investment, create jobs, and create stronger communities. And so, since we don't quite have the slide pulled up, what it says is our equity proposals are Emerging Entrepreneur Fund at $6 million one time, Youth at Work Program at $8 million one time, Pathways to Prosperity at $4.1 million one time, Office of Career and Business Opportunity at $2 million in one-time funding, Broadband, our border-to-border broadband development grant program at $100 million one time, and redevelopment grant program at $2 million one time. So our first order of business today is our Emerging Entrepreneur Fund. This is a new program that DEED is proposing that will be created by combining existing programs at DEED and seeded with one-time $6 million in capital. We know that some communities face far greater barriers than others to starting or expanding a business. And these barriers often relate to differing levels of access to capital. According to the U.S. Small Business Administration, women and minority-owned businesses operate with much less financial capital overall and a higher percentage of owner equity, even when controlling for other factors such as credit score. The data also show that some troubling patterns in the availability of financing with minority-owned firms significantly less likely to have loan applications approved than non-minority. Again, these patterns persist even when controlling for factors such as industry and credit score. This program is focused on making sure that every entrepreneur across the state of Minnesota has the resources they need to create jobs and grow our state's economy. That's why Governor Dayton is proposing the creation of a new Emerging Entrepreneur Fund. Currently at the state level, we do not have a program that is specifically targeting entrepreneurs of color for its focus. The Emerging Entrepreneur Fund would be focused on supporting entrepreneurs of color, women entrepreneurs, veterans, and individuals with disabilities that are starting businesses. This would be developed by combining existing state programs and a federal program into one fund. Those programs are our Business Development Competitive Grant Program, which focuses on providing technical assistance to business owners, our Urban Initiative Loan Program, which serves low-income census tracts within the metro, and one of our federally funded State Small Business Credit Initiative Programs, which is called the Emerging Entrepreneur Fund, that was created through stimulus dollars. We're combining those three programs into one Emerging Entrepreneur Fund, which means that nonprofits will have one application to submit to access both loan capital and technical assistance dollars for business owners. This also means that $5 million of the $6 million would be focused on loans and access to capital. $1 million would be focused on technical assistance. Because this is a revolving loan program, we are only asking for $6 million for one time because we will receive repayments to this loan program and do not expect to come back to you with additional asks in the future. We feel that the one-time $6 million capitalization will be sufficient to get this revolving loan program off the ground until repayments from our other programs start coming in over the next few years. Our next proposal is Youth at Work, which is a competitive grant, statewide program that currently exists at DEED. We are asking for $8 million in one-time funding to reach another 3,000 youth across our state. And while 3,000 sounds like a large number, we know that there were 50,000 youth last year that applied to participate in youth workforce development programs that were not served. This program is focused, and I believe is one of our top ways that we can move those economic disparities. Our youth are our most diverse population in the state, and so when we talk about the racial disparities that exist, if we can connect our youth with good jobs and learning both the soft skills of needing to come into work on time, working with a manager, what is it like to work with a professional mentor, and giving them access to that professional network that will assist them with college applications, assist them with future work experience. This is the number one investment we can be making to change those economic disparities. In our fiscal year 14-15, the Youth at Work program, over 75% of participants were youth of color and 28% of youth had disabilities. So as I mentioned, this one-time $8 million infusion into this program, we'd be able to serve another 3,000 youth statewide.
And Commissioner, can you cover the existing program funding versus the increment? I'm sorry, I can't read it.
From the slide, is that what you're
looking? Yes.
Mr. Chair? Yes, Mr. Chair. So the graph on the slide says state fiscal year 14-15, we received 38 proposals requesting $9.8 million, and we were able to fund 16 proposals at $5.4 million, which left 22 proposals unfunded. So there's $4.4 million unfunded. Total youth served was 8,624, and total youth unserved estimated was 27,000. In state fiscal year 16 through 17, we received 41 proposals for $14.7 million. 22 were funded at $6.36 million, and unfunded was 19 at $8 million. We were able to serve 10,000 youth, and total youth unserved was 25,000.
Thank you.
Our next focus within Governor Dayton's equity budget is our Pathways to Prosperity program. We just talked about our youth statewide competitive grant program. This is our adult statewide competitive grant program, in which we are asking for $4.1 million in one-time funding. Pathways to Prosperity is Minnesota's chosen model on how to address adults with barriers to employment and to get them on a track to a family-sustaining wage. This program asks that adult basic education institutions partner with higher ed institutions, partner with community-based orgs or workforce development organizations, and also partner with employers. Those groups need to co-apply for a grant, and together they're identifying what is the job in demand in their local area where there are multiple openings for an occupation, what is the target population that they will be focused on, adults with barriers to employment. It could be a single parent that has child care needs. It could be a low income individual with transportation issues. There could be a variety of factors, but individuals who are currently not working or have not been working for extended period of time or are working in low-wage positions. The group also needs to identify what is the training path that that individual will go on in order to be eligible for that job in demand, and has an employer committed to that partnership to be hiring the individuals when they get through the training. So instead of just sending individuals to our adult basic ed centers to get their GED or adult diploma, and once they get that, then they're done, we've identified a training path that will take them from that adult basic education into training with often a higher ed institution and directly connected to an employer. So it's targeting our populations that are experiencing those greatest disparities across our state, as well as filling a demand for employers in our with our labor force that is tightening, and employers have much demand for jobs such as nursing and welding and precision manufacturing, where we have multiple openings across the state. It is providing skilled labor force to fill those jobs. We are asking for $4.1 million in one time for this competitive grant program. This is a newer program. We actually combined two of DEED's existing programs into one to create this program 2 years ago. Our first round of funding, we had 33 proposals. In our second round of funding, we had 38 proposals across the state. And you should have a second handout in front of you that details those first 33 proposals that we received, so that you can see the partnerships that have been developed at the local levels between ABE and higher ed and employers all coming together and identifying these career pathways to target individuals with barriers to employment and get them on that path to a family-sustaining wage. We're seeing great success with this program, and I know that there are others here today that will share more details about their experiences with the program. Our final equity proposal is for DEED's new Office of Career and Business Opportunity, and that is for our office to have its own grant program focused on capacity building for culturally based nonprofits. We know that our way to reach into communities of color is to work with nonprofits that are also focused on serving those communities of color and represent those communities themselves. And our focus is to make sure that those nonprofits are as strong as they possibly can be. Some of them are newer nonprofits, and so we would like to offer a capacity building program specifically for those nonprofits to have third-party assistance. It could be an organizational development consultant. It could be working with an accountant, truly based on what the needs of that organization are, providing capacity for that nonprofit itself. The way that DEEDS programs are structured is that our funding that we receive, we often are loaning that funding to a nonprofit who is then serving a business or an individual. It doesn't occur that we are actually supporting the nonprofit itself. And so in our effort to make sure that we are doing outreach and deeply working with our communities of color across the state, we want to make sure to strengthen our culturally based nonprofit organizations across the state with this one-time $2 million fund. The other two proposals in Governor Dayton's budget for DEED are border-to-border broadband development grant program at $100 million. Minnesota policymakers...
I don't have to smile quite so much, Commissioner.
Minnesota policymakers set a number of visionary goals related to broadband internet access in 2010. Chief among them, the state committed to achieving border-to-border access to moderate levels of broadband service to every home in Minnesota and achieving a top ranking among states in the adoption and use of broadband technologies. Over the last 2 years, the legislature and governor have allocated over $30 million to the border-to-border broadband infrastructure grant program, leveraging more than $41 million in private investment. But now the governor has made a major commitment to reaching these goals by recommending $100 million into the program in the next biennium. These resources are especially beneficial and focused on rural Minnesota, where broadband connectivity needs are the greatest. While statewide needs are still significant and ensuring connectivity in the most difficult to serve areas is challenging, stakeholders across Minnesota have recognized the critical role that broadband plays in achieving economic development competitiveness, educational opportunities, and helping people stay in touch with health care providers to receive care and monitor their health conditions. We've heard lots of support for $100 million investment in Minnesota's broadband infrastructure, and with this level of funding, we'd be able to serve 35,000 businesses and households across the state. And our final item in Governor Dayton's budget is the redevelopment grant program at $2 million one-time funding. And I should mention before I leave the broadband slide is that we currently do not have any funding remaining in our border-to-border competitive grant program. Like the broadband program, redevelopment currently has no funding available at the moment. So the governor is proposing $2 million investment in the redevelopment grant program. This program assists local communities with redevelopment projects by filling the financial gap that often prevents recycling land into more productive uses. It serves communities across Minnesota in dealing with old industrial, residential, or commercial properties that are unused and would be valuable sites for economic development. Redeveloping dilapidated structures and dealing with an adequate adjacent infrastructure is more complex and much more expensive than developing previously undeveloped lands. Often, urban areas are landlocked and do not have ample vacant land for development. And similarly, in rural areas, redevelopment takes pressure off of the edges of cities and uses existing city facilities and systems, such as schools, fire and police protection, streets and highways, water and wastewater systems. The redevelopment program was not funded in the 2015 biennial budget, and as I mentioned, is now out of funds. As the only statewide tool to help local units of government and developers defray the costs of recycling property, we expect a large demand for funding once it becomes available. We have existing staff capacity to manage the program and would not need additional resources for administration. To date, this program has awarded over $64 million in grants, resulting in 1,250 redeveloped acres of land, more than 25,000 created or retained jobs, $36.5 million in increases to local tax bases, 5,000 housing units, and over $2 billion in leveraged private investment. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members, to allowing me to be here to present DEEDS budget items in the governor's budget. I'd like to reiterate that if these issues are left unaddressed, as Minnesota's demographic makeup continues to shift and minority racial populations continue to grow, Our employment disparities poses a considerable threat to the future economic growth and to the health and well-being of communities and people across our state. So I'm very excited about our proposal items for this year and ask for your support, and would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions for the Commissioner?
Sure.
Representative Lunan, and then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had made a comment about the fact that we were losing ground on the employment between people of color. Does that track to academic achievement directly at all? I mean, are we clipping a branch off the problem, or should we be addressing this at the root, where we have a culture of not applying themselves? Has anybody look, I mean, I'm assuming that data has been looked at,
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I personally disagree with your statement. From what I can provide from DEED's perspective, with our labor market information and when what we're focused on with our resources and programs, is that we know that achievement gaps exist in our K-12 system. We also know that there are employment disparities that exist among our communities of color in our state. Minnesota ranks at the top of so many lists, so many rankings when you take a look at how our economy is performing, and we're at the very bottom in the country when you take a look at the racial disparities in our state. And so our budget items are specifically focused on targeting our communities of color that are assets in our state, and ensuring that we are providing a pathway to success, since we know by data that not every Minnesotan, specifically communities of color with higher unemployment rates, are experiencing our prosperity in our state currently.
Representative Lunan, a follow-up, and then we'll go to Mahoney. Representative Mahoney.
Yeah, I'm going to ask the question again. It wasn't a statement, it was a question. Have they looked at the people with the employment problem? Are those the same people who aren't achieving academically?
So you're asking, is there a correlation between education?
Is there a correlation? And here's why I ask that. I did some time on the Shakopee School Board.
Oh, I thought you said did some time. I thought maybe somebody didn't know the record.
Sometimes that's what it felt like. But they we're able to drill down the numbers, and we found out that academic achievement was measured most accurately by people who simply didn't even turn in their work. Not by demographics, but by just not doing the work. And so we reacted to that, and we got some results from it. And I was just wondering if there's the correlation here. I mean, I understand what you're trying to do, and I support it. I'm just wondering if we can go down to this, rather than treating it at the symptom level, which is at the end, if there's things that are being done from an educational standpoint that creates I'll call it a culture, but an expectation of achievement. That was my question. I wasn't making a statement. I was just asking a question.
Commissioner Sieben, regarding linkage of education and...
Mr. Chair, Representative, yep, my colleague, Commissioner Casilius from the Department of Education, is very focused and has some pieces in the budget that she's working on within that K-12 system. What we know from a data perspective, if you do not achieve a high school diploma or degree, yes, that does have an impact on your future work opportunity and what wages you might be able to make. There is a correlation there.
As with most problems, rarely is there only one solution. There's a multifaceted solution. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to my colleague, Mr. Representative Lunan. It's kind of I understand the question, but it's a, we deal with, the 12, 13, 14-year-olds, the 24, 34, 44. I think your question is a valid one, if not a little bit more tactfully stated, for the Education Committee, because that really is a big piece of how young men and young women move into higher paid jobs. And there is an issue there, as it's not one solution. My question for the commissioner, I've got several of them, Mr. Chair, so I'll start with the emerging, and I better get these really big cheaters on. Emerging Entrepreneur Fund. This is a recommendation of $6 million one time. Statewide Lending and Technical Assistance Program. A couple of questions here. Is this... there are a number of different technical assistance programs for entrepreneurs and for existing businesses. An example of them would be the Neighborhood Development Corporations, which do a great job in the metro area. And Representative Gunther has been trying to get them out in greater Minnesota. And then Enterprise Minnesota, which does a fabulous job with our small and mid-sized manufacturers. Would those two organizations or organizations like them be eligible for these kind of funds?
Commissioner Stephen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes, they would. So some examples of previous recipients of our Business Development Competitive Grant Program that would also be good candidates for this new Emerging Entrepreneurs Fund are NEON, the Metropolitan Economic Development Association, MEDA, African Development Center, Women Venture, Enterprise Minnesota, Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians, Entrepreneur Development Program, among many others.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Madam Commissioner, I know three of the ones that you mentioned, they have documented track records that are easy to compare apples to apples against program to program. So I certainly hope that you have an apples-to-apples comparison for anyone that these emerging entrepreneur funds go out to, because it is really important for the viability of that program to be able to come back and say, we spent a dollar, we got a dollar's worth of value. And we can compare one group to another group and say that group didn't get a dollar's worth of value out of that dollar. I'm going to move on to pathways and just complain to the governor that he only did 4.1. I know there's a really good bill coming down the way that doesn't have appropriation in it, and you know I'm kind of talking about a $12 million fund on that one. So I hope the department would be able to meet all the grants with a $12 million need for the Pathways to Prosperity. My other question is the redevelopment grants. Reverend Gunther and I have been singing this song for a long, long time. You know, you come in here and you ask for these dollars, this $2 million does not meet up to the need for our rural economic centers and our urban economic centers. This should be, I know we've put more money into it. This is really an important piece, and not only just for our redevelopment, but it is a place where disadvantaged groups get a chance to come in, because we've got a lot of state money in it. They get an opportunity to come in because of the rules we set up to start learning construction skills. Maybe that's not what they have at the end of the day. They don't end up being a laborer at the end of the day. They go on and be carpenters or plumbers or pipe fitters or electricians. But it's a start for them. So can you tell me in an average year what your grant requests for the redevelopment program are?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I do not have that information in front of me at the moment, but I'd be happy to follow up with you to give you that number to the full committee.
And just for the committee's sake, when the commissioner was in my office, I did complain about this privately, and I will complain about it every day I'm alive, because we do not put enough money into redeveloping, and we end up taking farmland out of production. And then I won't mention names, but I know there's been three or four large companies that have come in and gotten subsidies, and then they come back a year or two later and they complain, I can't get anybody to take these jobs because there's no transportation out to where they, from my district, someone who would take a $20 an hour job or a $15 an hour job, you know, you got to be on the bus for an hour and a half one way and then walk 20 minutes in the middle of January to the job site. So it's a four-hour transportation every day plus 8 hours. It's 12 hours. If you're dropping off a kid or you're trying to get to a school deal, a school conference, and if these were done in the city or in city districts, we would not take farmland out of production. We wouldn't have to try to figure out transportation for these businesses, and people would have more time with their families, which might get to your question. So I'm sure you'll get me that information, but please share it with the rest of the committee if you want to have time.
So, commissioners, the total supplemental budget request is $122.1 million. Any estimate of how much of that would need to be used for increased administrative costs? I know one of the programs you cited there would be no administrative cost. If we just can get to answer later on, that'd be great.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, off the top of my head, we do not have any administrative costs included in the budget.
And then is there any interdependency between these programs? In other words, as we're prioritizing funds, mm-hmm. is there a connection where it really doesn't make sense to fund one of these without funding something else first within this bucket of six programs?
Hmm. Mr. Chair, members, it's an interesting question. They are not interrelated, where if you fund one, then another one doesn't work, but... I would argue that the current focus on equity in the governor's budget, that you would not want to just fund youth workforce development. I think you would want to fund adult and youth and business development to truly help move the needle in that area.
Understood. And then with regards to these, is there any policy language with these in terms of reforming how the programs are administered? None at all, just... Okay. Thank mm-hmm. you, Commissioner. Any other questions? Seeing none, Commissioner, we appreciate your testimony and thanks for being here today. Next, we have the Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Ms. Tingerthal.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I'm commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And with me is Katie Topinka, our legislative director. We're here today to talk about a fairly modest request that's part of the governor's supplemental budget that invests in kids, families, and communities, but is also a part of the governor's equity package. I met many of you last year when we were before you with our biennial budget, but just to remind you, our mission is that because housing is the foundation for success, we collaborate with individuals, communities, and partners to create, preserve, and finance affordable housing. We're all about housing, and we're all about working with communities to get it done where it needs to be done. Last year, just to give you a sense of scope, we provided over $1 billion in funding for housing, and less than 10% of that is made up of state appropriations. One of the things that the housing finance structure allows us to do is to leverage many other resources, such as federally tax-exempt bonds, federal tax credits, and federal rent subsidies, and we try to use state funds to really bring the maximum number of those dollars to the use of Minnesota citizens wherever we can. That was nearly 64,000 households that were touched by our programs last year. And to give you an idea what those households look like, 79% of the renters that received rental assistance through any of our programs, either federal or state funded, had incomes below $20,000, and that's throughout the state. And the home buyers that we assisted, about 60% of them had incomes of less than $55,000. So we truly are serving a low and moderate income part of the populations around the state. But we're very proud of the fact that last year more than 4,000 loans were made to homebuyers, more than any time in the agency's over 40-year history. And 30% of those homebuyer loans were made to households of color. And it was that record that turned us to making a proposal to the governor for what he included in our supplemental budget package this year. The proposal is for a total of $6.25 million. The biggest chunk of that, $5 million, is for our Home Ownership Assistance Fund. This is literally a program that has been funded with state appropriations for nearly the entire existence of the agency, but at a very modest level. We will talk a little bit more about how those dollars will be used. $1 million for intensive homebuyer counseling and homebuyer education, and again, I'll go into more detail. And then finally, a rental-related project, a pilot program for a landlord guarantee fund that will help to place people who may have trouble getting a lease signed because of fears that their landlords may have. So with that, there are no administrative costs that will come out of the $6.25 million to Minnesota Housing. There will be a small portion that's used by the local administrators of the home buyer and guarantee fund programs in order to administer those dollars. So talking now about the importance of home ownership, I think all of you in your communities are very aware of the social benefits for both families and communities of having a high level of home ownership. In Minnesota, we're one of the strongest homebuyer states in the country, and it's no mistake that we also have a lot of very strong communities. Home ownership is still, even after the Great Recession, one of the leading ways that low and moderate income households, Minnesotans included, can build wealth. It's been true since our parents and our grandparents, and frankly, that just hasn't changed. It's still a great way to build wealth. So over the past 40 years, when Minnesota Housing has been in existence, more than 85,000 families in Minnesota have purchased homes with the help of Minnesota Housing and our private lending partners. And that allows me to tell you that all of our loans in our homeownership program are originated by local banks and mortgage lenders in your communities, not by Minnesota Housing. And we have a wonderful network of lenders throughout the state of Minnesota that team up with realtors and local communities to make sure that homeownership is a high priority within those communities. So what's the challenge that we bring before you today? The challenge is closing the gap between homeownership rates of whites and households of color. The overall homeownership rate in Minnesota, as I mentioned, is one of the highest in the nation. In fact, we're number three at nearly 72%. The homeownership rate for whites is even higher at 76%, sixth in the nation. And the homeownership rate for diverse households is down at around 40%. So we have a 36 percentage point gap between white households and households of color. That puts us way down at number 47, or third worst in terms of the gap in homeownership rates throughout the country. And what we're proposing here today are some solutions that we think can go to work immediately to continue to help close that gap. So there are a number of dynamics to why that gap exists. One of them is the availability of wealth and down payment assistance to households of color. Another is previous credit and lending practices that were quite predatory. Another is homebuyer education. And finally, cultural practices are often different. When we're dealing with households of color, we're often talking about the first time for any member of a family in any generation to be owning a home. And that often takes a different understanding of what people's needs might be in making a decision to become a home buyer. One of the biggest gaps that I'll talk about now is just the lack of down payment and closing cost assistance, and it really is key. As little as $1,000 can lead to almost a 20% increase in the number of low and moderate income families that can purchase a home, and assistance up to $10,000 led to almost a 40% increase. So our assistance is frankly in between those two numbers. So our request in detail is $5 million for our Homeownership Assistance Fund. That's an existing program that would allow us to serve an additional 800 households. We provide between $5,000 and $7,500 in down payment and closing cost assistance. As I said earlier, they receive the mortgage loan through a private lender, and the down payment goes along with that. And all incomes of the people receiving assistance are at or below 60% of median income. But why are we here now to ask you for this? The reason is that, as you know, interest rates are historically low and have been that way for some time. And we've really seen first-time home buyers now having recovered from the economic downturn. They now have jobs, maybe have had jobs now for a couple of years. They're really beginning to see the advantages of homeownership. House prices have increased in Minnesota, but many are still quite affordable. And on the other side of the equation, in the rental market, since 2000, median rents have risen by 6% and are currently at almost $1,400 per month. Monthly costs for new homeowners are actually 22% lower than they were 10 years ago. That's not a typo. The reason is in the chart that you see below. The median house price in October of 2005 was $230,000. It's now $216,000. In other words, the median hasn't quite recovered to the pre-recession levels. But the big difference is the interest rate. Believe it or not, back in 2005, interest rates on 30-year fixed-rate mortgages were just over 6%. They are now at about 3.8%. I don't have to tell you that makes a huge difference in the amount of interest that's included in your monthly mortgage payment. So to afford a home back in 2005, you needed to be able to afford a monthly principal, interest, taxes, and insurance payment of $1,860, while this year it's only $1,460. We think this is too good an opportunity to pass up. So at Minnesota Housing, we really looked at this with my board of directors and said, what can we do more? Where can we put some emphasis to really try to close that homeownership gap? And despite the fact that 2015 was a record year overall for our homeownership lending, we increased the number of households that are the number of mortgages that were to households of color or Hispanic ethnicity by almost 70%. You can see going back over the last 8 years just what a dramatic increase that is in the actual number of households that became homeowners from households of color last year. I do want to put a face on this, and that is a couple of stories. Here we have Abrolfus Moshe, a 53-year-old originally from Tanzania with three kids. He works as a bookkeeper at a gas station at $12 an hour and part-time details cars at $9 an hour. He was renting a house for his family at $1,300 a month. With the assistance of a $7,500 deferred payment loan and an FHA first mortgage, he bought a home for just under $200,000, and his new mortgage payment is almost exactly the same as his rental payment. And remember, that's principal, interest, taxes, and insurance, not just the mortgage payment. Everybody was pulling for him, even his landlord, to make that change. The next part of our request we want to talk about is our homeownership capacity counseling program. It's a new program for us that we've tried out on a pilot basis. And frankly, we're really delighted at the results we're beginning to see. This allows nonprofit, culturally specific organizations to do a more intensive version of financial and homeownership coaching directly with families. And it's designed to close that credit gap, not the down payment gap, but the credit gap. It helps households stabilize their budgets and actually map out a path to qualifying for a mortgage. We've already got over 700 households who have started this program, and more than 90% of those households are households of color. So getting to the representative's point earlier, we really are getting people to tackle the whole problem at the front end and really getting them ready for responsible homeownership before we start to sit them down and see if they can qualify for a mortgage. An additional $1 million that's requested could serve 900 more families. We have 10 organizations listed on the screen, all of which are focused on culturally specific groups, ranging from Build Wealth, who I know you've heard from in this committee before, to Three Rivers Community Action that works in the southeast corner of the state, often with large immigrant families. This is another story of a home buyer that's been helped by Three Rivers Community Action in southeastern Minnesota. Jose Luis Luna Perez started in March of 2015 with a credit report 11 pages long and a credit score of 594. Through the homeownership capacity program, within 6 months, he'd improved his credit score to 631 and reduced his debt from $18,000 down to $6,000. He continued to work for a couple more months to improve his credit score and then began to work with one of our mortgage lenders and obtained an FHA loan and down payment assistance to close on his first home for him and his family. Finally, we have Michelle Sanchez here in the Twin Cities, who we thought we'd get someone a quote from someone who went through this themselves. It's programs like these that help real people with real families. Because of disparities and hardships, opportunities aren't always within reach. This is a lady who had lost her home to foreclosure after a difficult divorce and was faced with finding a home for her five kids. It was a counselor in the homeownership capacity program that helped her to understand that she could resume homeownership. She says, "I couldn't believe it. Here I was telling myself, I can't do this. I have to live in a bad neighborhood forever. I can't buy a house." But I was wrong. She has now completed the program and now is a home buyer too. Our final request is not related to homeownership, but equally important. In our work at Minnesota Housing, we work with the Interagency Council on Homelessness, and also the Olmsted Subcabinet, which is designed to help people who are living in institutionalized settings to find housing in the community. And what we find is that with rental markets being extremely tight across the state of Minnesota, oftentimes with 0% vacancy rates, it is often those who have a few barriers. Maybe a credit history that's not exactly the greatest, coming from an institutional setting or a criminal record, that landlords are quick to drop those people from a waiting list. And we have a couple of counties that have experimented with basically a safety net fund for landlords who are willing to sign a lease with tenants that meet these criteria. And in exchange, there is a very small guarantee fund that is basically a peace of mind fund, which will get that landlord to say, "I'll give it a try, but if that tenant causes damages or skips out without paying a month's rent, there'll be a place where I can get reimbursed for that." So it's something that we'd like to try on a somewhat larger scale and think it can really help with meeting some of our other placement housing goals. And with that, I will talk just a little bit about the process. The awards would be made competitively to counties and nonprofits through one of our existing programs. And there is about a 76% overlap between those experiencing homelessness and those that have either a serious mental illness, a chronic health condition, or a substance abuse disorder, so that we know what it, with this program, if we're successful, it will help in meeting several different housing goals. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. One of the success stories you mentioned, the gentleman, and I'm happy to hear about this, that he's got a new home. But working out the numbers on this, it looks like his principal and interest housing costs are going to be about a 50% debt-to-income ratio. How does that work for underwriting?
I'm assuming that you did the math on the amount per hour.
Well, I'm just, in my head, it looks, you know, make $12 an hour, that's roughly, say, $26,000 a year. Divide that by 12, we get a, you know, say, $2,300 for a monthly housing. And even with the part-time income, I mean, let's just say he makes $2,600, $2,700 a month. Standard underwriting guidelines are that over total debt shouldn't exceed 36%. And this is a case where the principal and interest alone, or the housing cost alone, is going to be over or near 50%. I'm just, and these are privately financed, right? These are loans.
That's correct.
So how does, I mean, that's beyond subprime. Do you know how they?
Yeah, my guess, Mr. Chair, is that there is probably another wage earner in the family.
Oh, okay.
We didn't give a, this was just a vignette. But all of these loans, just so everybody knows, are underwritten to standard mortgage banking, debt-to-income ratio, loan-to-value ratio, credit score, et cetera. They are all, in fact, standard for secondary market, are all done by regulated mortgage lenders. So there's no subprime lending here.
Gotcha. Super. I should have figured that out on my own. Sorry. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I just had a quick question for you going back to your recommendation for $5 million for down payment and closing cost assistance to serve an additional 800 households. I just ran the numbers really fast on this again, and I'm looking at $6,250 would be if you just divided into that, that would be per household. I just would like you to touch on just briefly of that $5 million, how much of that is projected to go out as actual assistance, and how much do you think would be used for administrative purposes?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there would be $0 used for administrative costs, so every dollar will go out into assistance. And just to clarify, all of these loans are made as deferred loans that are recorded as liens on the property, and so when that property is resold, those dollars are recaptured by Minnesota Housing and then recycled back into the same program. So with a long-term history of this, we do have the benefit that those dollars do come back over time.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. And by the way, thanks for your presentation. It's a little larger than the other one. I had a little trouble reading that, which maybe resulted in cutting down more aspen trees in northern Minnesota, but that's a whole other topic. I'm curious, I think it's your seventh slide of the challenge, Closing the Gap, and it talks about overall ownership rate, home ownership rate at 71% and so forth. Can you get me or us, the committee, what is the track on that? Where was that last year and 10 years ago? If it's in the presentation someplace, I'm sorry if I've missed that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, 2 years ago, Minnesota was dead last in the gap. So we were the worst gap in the country. So we've gotten a little bit better, but it's a big lever to move.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm looking for specifically are the percentages and how it's changed year by year over the last 10 years, something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have those with me, but we can certainly send them up to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. One of the issues that I've been addressing the last few years is market rate workforce housing, and there have been some conversations between you and I and our staff, and I hope that we can continue to work together to make sure that we do get more resources put toward that, and I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here today.
I know your this is your supplemental budget ask, and what did we? I don't recall what you were given last year. What your budget legislative budget was that we passed.
And Commissioner, if you don't have the answer, I'm sure that our highly capable staff has those numbers completely memorized and can cite them off the top of their head to the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Katie Topinka, again from Housing Finance Agency, and Representative Scott. For the Housing Assistance Fund specifically, so the Down Payment Assistance Program, the number for the biennium is $1.77 million. That's what was in the 16-17 budget.
Okay, thank you. And then I had some questions, Mr. Chair, if I might, on the Landlord Guarantee Fund. And if you could give me a little bit more specifics about how that's arranged. It says may include reimbursement for non-payment of rent damages above the security deposit. Do you drop individual contracts with these landlords, or how does this work?
The testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, this is purely presented to you as a pilot program, which is relatively undefined at this point. We would proceed if the funding were available to design some parameters for local administrators, either a county or a nonprofit, to administer the funds. Minnesota Housing itself would not enter into specific contracts with landlords. That would be done at the county level or at the nonprofit level.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so is this being done elsewhere in the country? Where did this idea come from? And can you, if it came from somewhere else, what have these successes been?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I don't have the exact results, which we'd be happy to share with you, but the most prominent example is in King County, Washington, which is Seattle, which is also a very, very tight housing market, very, very low vacancy rates and very high rental rates. And it was there that some of our staff and staff of Department of Human Services found this program. And as I said, there is a county in Minnesota that has been running a small pilot program. So it's not just a national model. There's a small program locally that is experimenting with this as well. But we'll be happy to get the results from the King County example to the committee.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you. One more question. Actually, this is really just more of a comment, and I know we have a tight rental market here, and finding housing for people of low income is difficult. And I just want to encourage any local units of government that are listening to this that one of the things they can do is stop regulating the heck out of rental markets and make a disincentive to provide housing for Section 8 and lower income people. They put a lot of obstacles in the way of landlords to the point where landlords no longer want to rent and take the risk of renting to people in those categories. So thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions or comments from members of the committee, Commissioner, we appreciate your testimony today. Look forward to working with you. And then also same question as we had for the Commissioner Deed. Will there be any policy language with these appropriations for the administration or changing of them?
No.
Okay, so with the so there'd be no policy language with the $250,000 either, the new program?
Mr. Chair, we would run it through the existing family homeless prevention program. So there would be some rider language to describe the pilot program. So I guess it would be within an existing program.
Okay, so is that language that we're going to be getting, though?
Yes, I expect it will come to your committee.
Good. Super. Thank you again for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, you're up. Representative O'Neill. Oh, no, I'm sorry, Commissioner Huffman. I didn't. The notes say that you weren't here, that you were in the Senate. So come on up, Commissioner. Sorry.
Thank you. I was hiding back there in the corner.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The Department of Commerce has two supplemental budget recommendations in your packets, and one of them is the funding stability for the utility rate analysis group, and the second is the Petra Fund renewal extension. I'll cover them, give you a highlight and then some of the detail, and then happy to answer any questions.
Commissioner, did you did staff bring handouts for it? Because I don't have it in my packet.
No.
No? Okay.
No.
So.
All right.
I would just go for the, I mean, if you have the governor's recommendations, it's that's the...
No, we don't. That's okay. Go ahead, Commissioner. That's fine. Well, if anyone has any questions, we'll wait until the commissioner's done. So thank you.
Happy to. The governor recommends increasing the Department of Commerce's energy regulation and planning unit staff in order to advocate for public interest in a timely manner in utility and energy proceedings before the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Funding will be moved from the general fund to the special revenue fund to allow the unit to assess regulated entities based on the workload. So to give you a little bit of background, the Energy Regulation and Planning Unit carries out statutory responsibilities and it provides the essential public service by advocating before state, regional, and federal energy regulatory bodies to promote the reliable, affordable, and environmentally sound energy for Minnesota. Currently, the Energy Resourcing Planning Unit employs a professional staff of 20 energy utility analysts who conduct highly technical analysis for the rate cases. The unit's workload has increased dramatically in recent years with numerous complex contested rate cases, certificates of need for major infrastructure such as transmission lines and pipelines, new solar standards and rates, utility resource planning, and a review of nuclear power plant upgrades. It's all a tremendous amount of work. Currently, this unit manages about 200 open cases. A special revenue fund would enable this unit to fulfill its statutory responsibilities in a more timely, responsive, and effective manner. It would allow our staff to hire consultants or themselves to address increased workload and the need for special expertise. Just some key points. You know, since 2010, so over the last 5 years, in nearly some major cases before the department, this unit has saved $429 million in its rate cases, nearly a 50% reduction in the utilities presentations. Currently, this unit has a number of cases, and there's nearly $390 million at stake in these cases. Just to put it in context, this unit, for every one person we have at the department, there is a contingent of four in the utilities. So we're clearly understaffed with respect to the amount of work that everybody is giving us. There has been more than $3 billion in new energy infrastructure that has run through the unit. This unit is also protecting Minnesota in regional and national proceedings, working with MISO, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and others. Fundamentally, this proposal is to create the special revenue fund to support the energy regulation planning unit's workload so that it's modeled, in fact, on an existing mechanism that is already used in our department's energy environmental review and analysis unit. That's the gist of the proposal. In essence, it just creates a special revenue fund to help us keep pace with the pace of all the utility filings in our department. The second proposal is an extension of the petrol fund for 5 years. The petrol fund program, with a recommendation from the governor, the program is funded with dedicated fee revenue and serves as the federally mandated financial responsibility mechanism for the state's petroleum tank owners and ensures a timely response to clean up contamination from releases. The program provides assistance to those who are cleaning up contaminated soil and groundwater from leaking petroleum storage tanks, with the ultimate goal of protecting the public health and welfare and the environment. In Minnesota, the petrol fund has served as the tank owner's financial assurance mechanism since 1987. The petrol fund sunset would negatively affect tank owners' ability to comply with federal law. It would also likely result in financial hardships for those tank owners who could not obtain alternative coverage and would be forced to pay on their own the costs related to investigating and cleaning up these tank sites. There are 21,400 properties across Minnesota that once held or currently hold a total of 45,800 federally regulated underground storage tanks. there have been many releases have already been addressed. Since 1987, the Petro Fund has provided financial assistance to eligible applicants that has allowed for 12,000 contaminated properties to be cleaned up. What is the work to be done? There are currently more than 600 open leak sites across the state, with more than 300 new releases reported to the state duty officer each year. Finally, the last point I'd like to make is that this has received the board approval of the Petro Fund. The proposed extension of the sunset date was approved unanimously by the Petro Fund board, which is made up of representatives from the petroleum and insurance industries, the public, and the Commissioners of Commerce and the Pollution Control Agency. Those are the two proposals. They're quite simple and stand ready for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. And the Petro Fund currently expires what end of what fiscal year?
This coming year.
So fiscal year 2017?
Yep. Okay. June 30, 2017.
Thank you. Any questions for the Commissioner? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is on the Petro Fund, and been following this for a number of years, but maybe I've asked this question in the past, but if you had 300 new releases this year, are these underground tank owners required to have cleanup insurance in order to get their underground permit?
Commissioner?
It's a federal requirement to have financial responsibility that petroleum storage tank owners have at least $1 million of coverage to address contamination from leaking tanks and pay third-party liability claims. But that doesn't always cover all the expenses. And for those that don't have the coverage, there's been this sort of some insurance and then the state programs to help assist with the cleanup. And for those that don't have it, this would, or there's lack of coverage for it, this would help for that.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because the Petro Fund is basically a hidden tax on consumers. How does a company or an individual have an underground tank if it's against the law or federal regulations to have an underground tank without having insurance? I mean, how do they get away with that?
What was the question, Representative Mahoney? Like, I didn't follow it.
So. There's almost 46,000 tanks in underground tanks in the state. They are required by federal law and I believe by state law to have insurance. My question is, how does a tank owner get away with having a tank underground if they don't have insurance? Because if they don't have insurance, they can't get the permit for the underground tank.
Right, but
how do they get away with that? How do they get away with breaking the law without being closed down?
Commissioner, isn't this like sometimes the cleanup costs are in excess of the insurance policy?
Exactly.
Yeah. Hold on. No. Commissioner, did you want to add up anything on that?
No. Yeah, I do. Right. Sorry. Good answer, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, my question, it's kind of like auto insurance. You're not supposed to drive unless you have auto insurance. And there's a ticket. There's a fine. There, you could have your license suspended. You could have your car possessed by the state. My question is who is in charge of making sure that these underground tank owners have insurance, whether it's the $1 million policy or multi-million dollar policy, and if they do not have insurance, whose responsibility is it to go to the tank owner and say, pull the tank, get rid of the tank because it could leak and you don't have insurance?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, my name is Joel Fisher. I'm the Executive Director of the Petro Fund Program. And the Petro Fund actually serves as the insurance for the tank owners. So the federal tanks have to have $1 million worth of coverage. The Petro Fund is the insurance coverage for that. Unregulated tanks, there is no actual insurance requirements. And so the Petro Fund does cover that as well, though.
Representative Mahoney, does that answer your question?
No.
poorly, but yeah.
Well, I think he answered it accurately. I don't think the answer was poor, but...
There you go.
Okay. Representative Lunan and Isaacson, and then we're going to Representative O'Neill's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I kind of want to dovetail off of that, the comment was made that there would be people with no insurance. Why don't we just require them to have coverage on their tank? I mean, it's available through brokerage outfits. And the second part of the question, I'm going to do it in two, is maybe $1 million isn't the right number anymore.
I tell you what, why don't we are going afield of the supplemental budget request. I certainly understand the policy questions. Maybe we'll have Petro Fund Day at the Capitol someday, but these are reasonable questions. If we could just have the department follow up with Representative Lunan on those, that would be appreciated. Is that okay, Commissioner?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Isaacson and Fabian.
Mr. Chair, my questions are the same, slightly different worded, so I will wait to hear back.
Good. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And real quickly, how is the petrol fund? It's a tax on gasoline. Is that how that's funded?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the petrol fund is funded through a $20 per 1,000 gallon fee, typically referred to as 2 cents per gallon. It's imposed whenever the fund balance drops below $4 million. And so it's imposed right now. It's on a four-month time period, and it automatically turns off. It's imposed around every 18 months right now.
Yep. Representative Scott.
Did you call me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You're he was whispering in my ear at the same time. I'm
That's
sorry.
That's a personal problem. Representative Scott.
Thank you. Just a really quick question on the Energy Division's ask that you have here. You mentioned that you'd be hiring more staff. How many and... How much of the 832,000? I'm sorry, did I say million before? How much of the 832,000 would be staff costs, and how many staff would you be adding?
Commissioner.
I'm looking for the 832,000 number that you're referencing.
That's the difference between the current general fund and then the special revenue fund? Is that the number?
Well, first of all, the answer to the first question is we're looking at our workload right now and preliminarily estimating somewhere between 4 FTE and potentially it'll depend on how the workload grows, but at a minimum 4 and maybe more.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative Scott, and all the members of the committee. Look forward to working with you this session, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill moves House File 2798 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Higher Education.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill,
I have
bill.
Two bills, and so I had to get the right to spare. So just for the sake of time, Chair, we're going to bring the pipeline bill up first, the dual training bill, some revisions to this. And my testifier has to leave in like 3 minutes. I'm going to let him testify first, and then I'll go into more of the detail of the bill. But this is the dual training bill come back, and we're trying to make it a little bit easier for industry and easier to administrate and meet some of the goals a little bit better and faster. So to my testifier, who is actually from industry and has some experience with the grant, and if you want to let us know what.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mitch Thiel. I'm the Vice President of Technology for a company called Design Ready Controls.
Please continue with your testimony.
We're a growing manufacturing company. We build what's called electrical controls. They're complex controls that run most of the machines in the world, like the air conditioners on the top of the building and things like that. The company itself has grown the last 8 to 10 years. We probably went in that time from a $1 million company to about a $50 million company. We recently opened a new facility in Brooklyn Park. And so growing a manufacturing company is all about finding the right talent and people with the right education. So we're plugged in with a lot of the minority communities. We're plugged in, especially with some of the two-year institutions, Hennepin Tech, Century College. We're also plugged in. We're on the industrial steering committees for like Mankato State. So we've grown our company working with people that are looking for manufacturing jobs. In other words, it starts if you can work fast, if you can work accurately, there's a place for you at our company. But the what we're building is so complex. People on the floor are working with computers, they're working with automation, they're working with manufacturing processes. Anybody that we get in that can work well for us, education is a huge plus, because there's always the need for people to be able to, again, handle these processes, handle the automation. So this pipeline program has fit very well with us. We're obviously doing the mechatronics portion of it. We're using mechatronics to build mechatronics, basically. And so, again, we're bringing people in. We've got four people enrolled in this past semester, but I believe we'll have up to 20 people enrolled in the coming semester, mostly as we work kind of through the administration of it and get the ball rolling. And again, that probably represents at least 10% of our company will be enrolled in the program this year.
Thank you. Because our testifier has to leave, we'll take questions now for the testifier. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative O'Neill, did you have an additional testifier?
I do. I have Jessica Lumen from Dolly and Nicole Sorensen from Office of Higher Education, just to talk about some of the challenges and why we're bringing this bill today.
Okay. Representative O'Neill, are the other two testifiers, Mr. Mosier and Dukowitz, are they here or not?
I don't believe so.
Okay. So these are your final two testifiers then?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jessica Lumen. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and really excited to talk to you a little bit about the pipeline project and the work that we're doing at our agency to really use what is a very traditional training model, an employment-based training model known as registered apprenticeship, and how we're using that to really expand into this dual training program through this this innovative and relatively young and innovative project that we're still developing and continuing to improve as we go on. As you know, the Minnesota Pipeline Project was passed by the legislature in 2014 and then with some modifications for the dual training grant program in 2015. And it's really based on employment-based training as opposed to education-based training. And that's what makes it different, is it's really employer-driven, it's occupation-driven, and it's industry-led. We do the pipeline project really in three ways. We use industry councils, which are groups of employers, employer associations, labor organizations, educators who really are focused on growth in a specific industry to give us direction in terms of how the project should proceed, as well as identifying in-demand occupations for that industry that can be really taught in the dual training model. And then we take those occupations and we develop competency councils, which is we have subject matter experts who actually say what the competencies are for those specific occupations. And then we do dual training development. And just a sort of an overarching component, dual training is three things.
Deputy Commissioner, if I can just interrupt you for a quick second. Are these things that are new to the program that are in this bill right now, or are you describing the existing program?
Mr. Chairman, I'm giving a big, broad overview of the program, but I can just jump straight to new.
Yeah,
how's that sound?
Why don't we just discuss the changes?
Let's go straight to new. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, you do have a handout that describes the program, and happy to answer any questions about it. Really, the only change that is new to the bill, and I know that Representative O'Neill, who is a big champion of this project, is going to go through the bill. But the piece that really affects the Department of Labor and Industry is actually at the very end of the bill, which really clearly identifies that those people that were serving in this program, they need to be employees of the employer when they are participating in the grant program and the dual training and the pipeline program, but they don't have to be current employees of the employer, which means that employers who want to participate in these programs can be in the process of recruiting new workers, particularly new young workers, and still continue to participate in the program, particularly in the dual grant components of it. So again, because it's industry-driven and because it's employment-based, that employer-employee relationship is very important for this project, and we're learning how to really be more adaptive and flexible in meeting those needs.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Mahoney.
And this is, I know we're dealing with policy, but I have a question on the finance. What is the cost to the Department of Labor and Industry to run this program every year?
Ms. Luman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, the Department of Labor and Industry has appropriated $200,000 a year to administer this program.
And how many, Mr. Chair, Ms. Luman, how many participants do you have in this program?
Ms. Luman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we currently have, and again, well, I'll sort of defer to Representative O'Neill and my colleague from the Office of Higher Education who's administering the grants, but we currently have over 120 participants in the dual training program grants, as well as we're working with 40 employers in addition to the 15 we're currently participating in developing these types of programs that could reach many, many more workers than that.
Representative Mahoney.
Ms. Luman, in your current apprenticeship programs, what is the cost to the Department of Labor and Industry for, I believe it's just shy of 10,000 apprentices?
Ms. Luman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, the apprenticeship unit of the Department of Labor and Industry currently has a annual appropriation from the Workforce Development Fund of $779,000. Actually, in the governor's supplemental budget, which you'll be hearing from Commissioner Peterson later this week, we are actually asking for an increase in that appropriation.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of policy questions related to these changes I'd like explained. The first one is, when you say that you strike the requirement that an employee receives a grant can now receive a second grant, before it says that it could not, why is that?
Ms. Luman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Isaacson, I think maybe in terms of the dual training grant appropriation part, do you want me to have Nicole come up?
Or Ms. Sorensen, you want to come on
Let's
up?
Let's do that.
And you might as well stay up here in case, because it sounds like Representative Isaacson has a couple of questions.
I have several.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Nicole Sorensen. I'm a research analyst with the Office of Higher Education, and I'm administering this program. To answer your question, the change is being made so that people can receive a grant for more than one academic term, since the requirement is that these individuals would be working as well as attending some type of training. You may not be able to finish a one-year certificate program in 1 year because you're not necessarily going full-time. That's not a requirement. So it's to allow for some additional time to complete the training. And also, I think that over time, they would like this to expand to associate's degree programs, et cetera.
Representative Isaacson.
So my understanding was when the legislation was first written, the idea was we didn't want someone who kept going back from multiple programs taking advantage of it that way but got into the workforce. How does this stop that from happening if you're allowing for multiple grants?
Ms. Sorensen.
Thank you. So if you can... Individuals will be able to receive a grant for the same occupation for a multiple-year program. So it wouldn't be for a different occupation. It wouldn't be going back.
So it specifically says that it's only...
Ms. Sorensen, please finish.
So then they wouldn't be able to switch occupations, but they would be able to do a two-year program within the same occupation.
Sure.
Representative Isaacs.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming then that that is specifically laid out in the bill.
Ms. Sorensen?
I don't believe it's included in the current legislation. It is a requirement in our grant program itself.
Representative Isaac.
So then that means, okay, so that doesn't repeal that part of it. It's just changing that it allows for someone who goes longer than 2 years to be there. Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaac.
Mr. Chair.
Hold on. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to address one quick thing, too, just to clarify that from what Nicole said. It's actually clarification that it's now a maximum of $6,000 per year. So it gives them more time, like she was saying, so that they can work and go to school, which is a challenge to do that. So it just gives them more flexibility.
Good. Representative Isaacson.
Which I can appreciate, and I think that might be a good change. The second question I have is when you are asking the Department of Higher Education or Department of Labor to put an inventory of degrees, certificates, credentialing programs, blah, 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 is that similar to the process we use to credential the programs for the different areas of specialty we were going to create for the pipeline? Because we had talked about in the past where we had a process of making sure that we credentialed how we were going to create a standard that we were going to work with, and I'm wondering how this plays into that standard.
Ms. Sorensen or Ms. Luman?
I think Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Isaacson. So one of the, again, we're learning a lot as we're doing this program, and one of the things that we have learned is that once we've developed the competencies, which we're doing, which
that's what I was looking
at. Yeah, the competencies, which we're doing with industry leaders, and education is at the table. But one of the things that we've learned is that how the next step to that process is once you identified a competency, and you can see that it's, you know, there's industry-related competencies and specific occupation-related competencies. Then we need to go to our higher education institutions, and we need to match the competencies with the courses that are being offered at those schools so that we can get the related instruction component of dual training to really be effective, streamlined, and ready for the student workers to participate in. So that's what the inventory does, is it does that match between what the competencies are that are industry recognized with the coursework that is currently and could be in the future available through our higher education systems.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eisen.
Oh, please.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to expound on that, too, the change also includes that the employee must receive an industry-recognized degree, certificate, or credential upon getting their training. Mm-hmm. So they're not just getting very specialized, you know, a couple course training, but it's actually, again, portable, which is part of the, remember we talked about that being a really important component. And so this adds to the portability.
Sure. Representative Isaac, then.
So, in the interest of time, and because I'm on the higher ed committee, my next question is a higher ed question, so I'll save that. My next question is, you ask for information on the grant application by employers to discuss or project the number of employees that have degrees, graduate in high school or GEDs, that year or the next, and I'm asking why we're asking that and what happens if they don't.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
So I'll take that real quickly. So the reason that we're asking is because what we found as the program rolled out is that it was very, very heavily focused in incumbent worker, and that really didn't get at the issue. So the issue for industry is to get new workers in, and so when the industry, so when the stakeholders met again about how this was working or how it wasn't working, one of the concerns they had is they really needed new workers in. So there is a shift in focus to high school equivalent, whether it be a GED or high school educated, and focus be there as opposed to someone that has already received training. Mm-hmm. And so it's really just an ask, like, are they being mindful of that? And it's not like they say they're going to have three high school grads and they have to have three high school grads, but it's really a projection as to what they plan on doing. And they can actually apply for the grant before they hire the person, so it gives them more flexibility, but before the person is enrolled in the courses, they have to be an employee. So the industry was saying we don't have enough flexibility, and it's too cumbersome on the front end, and so we're trying to streamline things.
Representative?
So when you go to Subdivision 5, correlating or piggybacking on that,
yeah.
My understanding when we had worked with the bill last year was that there was a component that already regulated this idea of incumbent versus new workforce. Did that not translate through to the final bill?
Representative O'Neill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Isaacson, so it didn't work real well in practicality because it became a very complicated grid because it had to be Greater Minnesota versus Metro and incumbent versus new worker, and so it just became very cumbersome. And so as the stakeholders came forward to express their concerns, industry said they really needed new workers more so than taking their incumbent and retraining them or accelerating their training. So that's why there is a new focus in trying to get new people into the industries, which is sort of the beginning goal of where we started.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Nicole has a...
Oh, thank you. I would just follow up, Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson, that this also allows OHE the flexibility to target the grants in that way to prioritize recent high school graduates or recent GED completers in our grant awarding process to more specifically get at that goal, which we weren't really able to do as effectively in the first round of grants. So I think this language change with number 2.14 and 1.5 and then under subdivision 5, that combination helps us to be able to do that a little more effectively in our grant awarding process.
Okay. Representative Isaacson.
So when we're going through further along Subdivision 5, we talk about how we want the commissioner to look at equal grant amounts between metro and non-metro, blah, 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 but it also says to consider the on-job training the employee receives. How are we considering that as a factor in their training and their credentialing in the classwork? And I assume that still applies to new employees, not ones we've already incumbent workforce. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson, so again, because there are three components to dual training, which is the employment, which is one of the things we're trying to get a bit more flexibility with in the timing in. Related instruction was where the inventory comes in, the degree programs, the certification programs, so that we're really moving people into career development programs. The third component is that structured on-the-job training. And so this highlights that we're really looking at real dual training programs and that there'll be consideration given to the strength of the structured on-the-job training components that the employer is putting in place.
I have one more, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for wrapping up, because we're running a little bit behind here.
Okay. The last part is perhaps the one that I'm most concerned about. I think you've had some very satisfying answers so far, so I appreciate that. But I'm looking at where we talked about the payment of the grant. And my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're asking the employer to have some skin in the game. That was a major component to this. And it looks as though the language allows for employers that decide they don't have the ability to pay to be covered elsewhere. Is that correct? And so what I'm seeing is it's saying the commissioner may pay the institution program directly if the employer demonstrates an inability to pay for the training in advance. Or is that to allow for an employer who may not have a lot of capital and the time to pay for it over time and give them the flexibility so they're not excluded from it? Is that what we're saying?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so the second part is correct. So it just gives that employer a little bit of flexibility because we're talking about industries that have very tight margins and cash flow is very difficult. So if they can demonstrate to the commissioner that they can't pay for this in advance, then they can the grant can be paid and then they can... So would I say that the other way? So if they can't pay for it, yeah, so then the OHE would pay for it.
And finally, and I'm done, that means I want to be clear about this, that we're not allowing a mechanism in here at all that would say that at some point the employer may be left off the hook for the amount that they owe as a part of this process. Is that correct?
Representative O'Neill?
So, no, that certainly is not the intent. There still is the skin in the game of 25% of the cost, which would be, you know, if it was 6,000, it would be 25%.
Wait, not the intent, or it does not allow that?
No, it doesn't allow.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Clark.
Just a quick question. I'm trying to understand this chart that has industry and occupations. And so I was looking at agriculture. And agronomist, is that the goal then for the person who's listed in the next category, which is mechanic, industrial truck, or is it going the other way? I just think it's great that this can also be applied to agriculture. I was trying to understand how this goes forward.
Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark. So all of those 16 areas that you see on your grid have all, those are all completed. Those competencies have been put together. And right now they're working on matching what MNSCU does with the competencies. So, and I believe there's actually one more in addition to this grid of 16 that is either done or almost done, and I think I'm going to toss it back to my testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, so the original pipeline mission was to develop competencies in entry-level and higher-level occupations so that we could do some stacking and credentialing,
right.
And so there is not necessarily a direct mechanic truck, industrial truck relationship to the agronomist. Agronomist in and of itself is an occupation that you can pursue under the dual training program.
Okay.
But the industry really is looking at those stackable occupations.
Okay. We can talk more later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill renews her motion to... is there any other questions? Representative Mahoney, my apologies.
More of a quick comment. Members... The cost to this is approximately $1,600 per participant. This was really a business-focused job training program. The typical apprenticeship program, which is paid for by the apprentices and the industries that use it, is about $100 per participant. And the majority of apprentices in today's apprenticeship programs are union construction workers, which the union construction contractors and employees put over $10 million per year and only cost the state $100 at maximum. This program is primarily state grants, loans, and appropriations that are significantly more. So I want everyone to understand that this is a real gift to the industries at our cost, at our taxpayers' cost.
It's not a question, it's just a comment, and I don't like this particular program if anyone has a question about that.
Any other questions or comments? Anyone want to speak for or against the bill? Seeing no one, the Representative O'Neill renews her motion to send the bill, House File 2798, to Finance Committee. To higher ed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same vote.
No.
Motion carries. And Representative O'Neill, your next group.
Yes. So while they're coming up, I'll just give you the quick introduction, Mr. Chair. This is House File. Do you want to make the motion first before I can?
To your bill, yep. To move. The motion to move Bill 3066.
Motion to.
Oops, sorry. House File 3065 to be laid over for inclusion in a future possible bill. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I have with me the YMCA of Minneapolis. Excuse me. Sorry, YWCA. I was still on the other bill. The YWCA of Minneapolis. And they have become an industry leader addressing the achievement gap by providing high-quality early education. So to further this mission, the YWCA has established the Early Childhood Education Professional Development and Credentialing Program. That program enables participants to achieve the Child Development Associate Credential, which is the most widely recognized and respected credential in early childhood education. This bill will enable the YWCA to significantly expand this professional development program, improving the quality of the workforce and the quality of early childhood education here in Minnesota. And for that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier from the YWCA.
And state your name for the record, please, ma'am.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Becky Roloff. I'm the president and CEO of the YWCA of Minneapolis, and thank you very much for the time today. The YWCA addresses disparities in education through high-quality early childhood education, and we can say that we have no learning gap at the YWCA of Minneapolis. The Child Development Associate Training Program is designed to address both income disparities as well as a professional credential and a career pathway to low-income Minnesotans. Over the past several years, we conducted a pilot program to provide training and support through the Child Development Associate Program, and that operates out of our early childhood site, which is on the campus of Abbott Northwestern Hospital. The impetus for the program was a comprehensive review that was conducted by the Wilder Foundation of a program that we call the Bungalow Program. The report provided to us by Wilder was very complimentary of the quality of the program. We're happy to provide that to you. Wilder had simultaneously identified a trend in startup child care centers in new American communities and urged the YWCA to consider finding a way to support quality early learning to this community, particularly to new Americans. The target population for this program is low-income workers, particularly women and particularly new Americans. The CDA certificate is recognized nationally. This would include the National Association for the Education of Young Children as well as Head Start, and it recognizes high school equivalent experience from other countries as a prerequisite to the program. Once attained, this certification can be used in any setting, a home-based center, a large centers like we have, or Head Start. So this gives people a real credential for a real job and a real career path. We believe we are uniquely qualified to deliver this training program. We have a commitment to inclusion. 50% of our workforce in early child education identifies people of color. We have 6 sites across the Twin Cities that can serve as training sites, and we are recognized nationally for our inclusive and high-quality curriculum. 95% of all the children in our centers test ready for kindergarten. Two-thirds of these children live in poverty. We currently provide CDA training and coaching for approximately 18 of our own employees. What we are requesting for your consideration is an investment of $500,000 that would open the program to workers across the Twin Cities and allow us to ramp up to 100 per year within a two-year program. And I would like to now introduce Yvonne Garrard, who is an employee of the YWCA at our Abbott Northwestern Center and is one of our cultural specialists.
Welcome, Ms. Garrard. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. My name is Yvonne Garrard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, the community, for following me to speaking with you today. I began my career in child care in 2009 as a volunteer with YWCA through community program calling in the CABI, the Center of Asian or Pacific Island. In 2010, the YWCA hired me as a substitute classroom aide. In 2013, I was promoted to cultural specialist. And in 2014, I began my CDA training. This training gave me the opportunity to earn more money to help my family. I have two children at home. This training gave me the opportunity. I really enjoy working and teaching young children. Their brain are fresh and they can learn so much, especially language. In our infant room, we speak many languages with children, Somali, Spanish, Arabic, English. It is good for children to hear a lot of different language. I'm different now. I used it to think I was just a substitute. I didn't know how to teach. I just did what the teacher is asking. Now I have training, and I feel good about teaching. And also, I come in high road because I start working in zero experience. Thank you, Ms. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions for the Representative O'Neill or the testifiers? Seeing none, anyone from the audience want to speak for or against the layover for a future bill? Seeing none, Representative O'Neill renews her motion to carry over bill House File 3065 for inclusion in a future bill. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Mahoney, looking at the clock, can we do this? You're the guy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to move House Files 2716 for, I believe it's being held over for possible inclusion. And Mr. Chair, I could be very quick here. I have a couple of testifiers. The career pathways, you heard a bit about it from the commissioner a little earlier. These programs provide a critical support and training to help people get the skills necessary to obtain better jobs. It efficiently combines basic skill instruction, job training, and wraparound support services to empower people to advance in their careers. They meet specific requirements for each. They are flexible enough to meet the specific requirements for each and every region in the state and industries and individuals across the state. The one reason that I am so supportive of career pathways is we have significant workforce shortages looking us in the face. In the next 6 years, we need to either replace or create or find workers to fill new jobs to a total of over a half million in 6 years. This is a good place to start. This is probably the best place, in my opinion, to start. And Mr. Chair, I would, as an amendment, I would put in $12 million on line 1.6. and either go big or go large or go home.
Representative Mahoney wants to amend his bill to a figure of $12 million. Be laid over for possible inclusion. So, yeah, we're going to vote on the amendment first. All right, we have the $12 million. We have the bill in the form that the author wants. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to present a couple of testifiers. Of course, I left my... Are we going to have Ahmad go first?
Yeah, I'll move.
Please.
State your name for the record, please, sir.
I will try. Hi, Chairman and committee members. My name is Ahmed Ali. I'm currently a program student. I am a student, but program participant in the transportation and career pathway offered by Goodwill Easter Seals and at Dakota County Technical College. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm honored to be participant in this hearing and tell you my experience and with the Pathways to Prosper program. I have earned through them. I have earned automotive maintenance and light repair certificate in 2015, and currently I'm a full-time student at the DCTC, Dakota County Technical College. That is scheduled to. That's scheduled for me to earn an associate degree to 2017, with another certificate while working part time. Before I decided on the transportation pathways, I learned about through Goodwill Easter Seals. I originally attended another community college. But I was very unsuccessful, and balancing work and also classes, navigating the U.S. college system, how to create a long-term career goals through transportation pathways. I learned necessary skills to successfully. successfully both in my education and also career, with the help of the APE, Adult Basic Education teachers, I increased my communication and math skills and while learning how to properly study, with the help of my my college and career navigator, Roger, I learned how to navigate the U.S. college. Actually, I mentioned that, set long-term goals for my career and creating steps to achieve them. I gained more than just an industry certificate. I'm actually having a lot of connections with a lot of, because of them and the Goodwill Associate and Dakota County Technical College. I am a part-time student, I have a part-time job with, right now I am a full-time student, and thank you, Chairman and committee members. That's be all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Mahoney, you have another testifier?
Yes, I'll let.
Was that allowed?
You were great.
All right.
Mr. Magali.
James Smarga from IRE.
And could you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Jane Samarja, Executive Director of HIRED. HIRED is a nonprofit organization in Minneapolis that provides employment services for around 8,000 people a year throughout the metro area. But today I'm representing the Minnesota Employment Services Consortium, MESC. MESC is a group of nearly 20 nonprofit employment service providers dedicated to improving the lives of low-skilled, low-income workers and also meeting the needs of our employers. Together, all of our memberships serve approximately 50,000 people a year here with employment and training services. And we are probably the first ones to know that there is a huge opportunity gap, not only in the nation, but certainly right here, with a significant number of our population facing underemployment or unemployment. The opportunity gap, as we've heard today, affects African Americans and other people of color disproportionately. Community-based organizations are critical partners in Career Pathways work. We are reaching individuals who often do not see higher education as an option for themselves. For example, at Hired, 76% of the participants in our Career Pathways training programs are people of color. With short-term training and industry-recognized credentials, we offer points of entry for low-income people who need a job while they are getting an education. These stackable credentials make a huge difference in earning potential down the road. For example, among our manufacturing career pathway graduates at Hired, their income tripled from pre to post income after graduating from training. Another example from Goodwill, Easter Seals Transportation Career Pathways Training Program, participants doubled their pre and post-training income. So these career pathway programs really work. They also work so well because we offer critical wraparound supports needed for individuals to succeed in higher education. Community-based organizations are the glue that helps low-income participants enroll in and complete training and then go on to post-secondary classes. Our programs are employer-driven and employer-advised. As community-based organizations, we are responding directly to employer needs with employers serving on business advisory councils and helping to shape our curriculum and update it as their industry needs change. With additional Pathways to Prosperity funding, we would be able to serve additional individuals to help prepare them for the jobs that are available. Some MESC members currently have waiting lists for their short-term industry-driven training, including automotive, information technology, healthcare, construction, early childhood development, and hospitality, and many others. And what that tells us is there are many, many low-income, unemployed people who want training, who want to participate, want to complete training, and we need to expand the program to accommodate them. We also know that placement rates are very high from these programs, and that adds support to the need for more funding for this program. As Representative Mahoney mentioned, we need to create workers for 500,000 new jobs in the next 5 to 6 years. We know we can do it. We have evidence that we can do it. We have organizations all over town with people walking in our doors saying, I'd like to get some training. I want to go to work. I need to support my family. And we are here to tell you the Career Pathways programs work, and we would like to see them expanded. And thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Ali, before I give Representative Mahoney the final statement, I want to congratulate you on your effort. There are people watching your successes that are going to be inspired by that, and you're not going to even know some of them are watching. So I want to take a moment and congratulate you. Representative Mahoney, in closing.
In closing, Mr. Chair, there were several other witnesses that would care to testify, from Ann Mulhone and Ann Klizer from the Workforce Councils and a few others. But just the support that this particular program has, and I'm going to read just five or six people here, Ameriprise Financial, Goodwill on Greater Twin City United Way, the Jewish Family and Children, J.P. Morgan Chase, St. Paul Community Literacy Consortium, the Urban League. There's 20 of them. This is a program that really does actually work, and we need it over the next generation.
Thank you.
So please... I'd like to renew my motion for possible inclusion of $12 million or better for in what I expect will be an omnibus.
Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 2716 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same motion. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, members, we stand adjourned.